So hey everybody, welcome back to Voices from the Frontlines. This is Eric Mann, your host. I'm really happy to have with us another very important figure in the movement, a really fine long-distance runner, Bill Fletcher. How you doing, Bill?
I'm doing great. It's raining cats and dogs here, but otherwise I'm hanging in here.
And where is there?
Maryland, right outside the nation's capital.
Got it, got it. Well, Bill, you have a very long and impressive history in the movement. A lot of people are going to read about Bill in my book, Playbook for Progressives. You've written some very fine books about the labor movement. You've helped to lead Trans Africa. We could go through your whole history. But a particular thing, since we had dinner in St. Louis and trying to make the show, like we're still having dinner in St. Louis, but a couple of people listening, hopefully. So one of the things I've been struck by, Bill, is that you have been so committed to building organization. And very few people really get that. There's a lot of people who have opinions, a lot of people who have activism, but you've helped to build the Black Radical Congress. At this point in history, as I'm going around the country, I am talking to some of the more advanced organizers for advice. And the thing that I find very interesting is people are in a very introspective mood right now. People are not being very triumphalist nor depressed, but they are trying to figure out some questions that we don't have the answer to. Is how is this country moving so far to the right when we had hoped the Obama administration would be a tremendous, we really did have a great hope for a left opening. I can go into all the other questions, but what are you grappling with right now? What are some of the questions that you're trying to figure out?
I'm trying to figure out what timeline we have that we're operating under in order to save the planet. Mm-hmm. We grew up, you and I, our generation, grew up in many ways believing that we had sort of endless time and that the struggle was long-term, and the struggle is long-term. But what we didn't grapple with, except in the sense of the fear of nuclear catastrophes, was that this planet could be destroyed by capitalism. And literally destroyed, and that we could find ourselves with the collapse of civilization. And so I feel this incredible urgency, Eric, that we've got to do something. I'm also grappling with what will it take to get people in the United States to understand the very notion and nature of empire. And that we, much of what we are surrounded with in this country is a direct result of empire.
Right.
And that you can't turn a blind eye, for example, to the Congo, when in reality we wouldn't have cell phones if it wasn't for the Congo and the materials that come out of the Congo. And there's this way that people in the United States, so many people, walk around with this combination of naivety and self-imposed ignorance and self-righteousness that acts as if this country got where it is on its own. It was bootstrap time, rugged individualism. We did it on our own. Oh, yeah, there was this unfortunate thing called slavery, but we got over that.
Right.
And I'm grappling with that, Eric. How do you talk with regular people and win them to understand this issue of empire? And I guess the other thing, there's a lot of other things I'm trying to grapple with. How do we turn the trade union movement around?
Right.
And how do we build the sort of majority coalition in this country? Because, to this question of why the country is moving to the right, one of the things...
Bill, let me interrupt a second, because you got some really great stuff, and I don't want to lose the opening, okay?
Yeah, sure.
It's funny, because it's like you could have been at the Strategy Center last night. I think it was Monday night, because it's interesting that... I don't know. I'm not saying you haven't before, but your discussion of ecology is so interesting to me, because that is a question that, and the Strategy Center was formed in some way around this intersection between environmental justice and the trade union movement, right, and the sort of struggle for more cars in L.A., and now we have a campaign for no cars in L.A. But in the last 2 or 3 years, I think the whole organization and the whole people I'm talking to have had the exact same concept that you've been saying, almost word for word, which is, we thought the class struggle could go on forever, and you'd say, all right, this is a bad century, or, you know, this is a bad, you know, we had a bad couple of decades.
Right.
It's the first time, and we really could at least metaphysically believe in a sort of infinite hope. And now we're being told, no, you don't get it. Whatever you human beings want to rationalize, there are forces that capitalism has put into force that are unleashing a set of exponential explosions, like nuclear, that if we don't throw ourselves in front of the machine, I'm just thinking of Mario Savio, if we don't really have, we're not playing, folks, we are talking decades. And we're already talking that's happening now in the third world. So it's not like one day it's going to happen. So that's great. Your opener is just for what's interesting. We're almost like, of course, you and I have been talking for 30 or 40 years. So that's one thing I think is great, if I may say. It's great because I agree with you. But anyway, and the second thing is the issue of empire, which we have been challenging ourselves at the Strategy Center more about, have we really raised the question of empire as a frontal mass question? And I think our answer is no, although we've been, you know, always wanting to, always doing it pretty well, but not sufficient, not at the level of making it the frontal question. So I just think that's interesting about, I'm not coming up with answers yet, but those two questions about class consciousness and mass ecological consciousness, I just think maybe the two biggest questions we're facing, and the two words that you laid out are the same two that I would lay out as well.
Well, you know, I'm not surprised. I mean, as you said, we think along very, very similar lines. I think that on this issue of the environment and capitalism, that the Terminator series actually is a very good metaphor, in the sense that you have these machines that are produced that then become self-aware and they proceed on their own with their own objectives, and they destroy everything that they can, specifically humanity. Hmm. Well, that's essentially capitalism. That the system is completely amoral. The system has to continue. It has to seek ways of gaining greater and greater wealth, even if that includes exterminating huge portions of the planet. And so part of the thing, see, I think that you have done a great job around empire. And it's not, and there's too many people on the left that think that talking about empire is simply about solidarity marches and good slogans. It really is making internationalism something that's real to regular people, that it's talking about immigration, but talking about it in a different way. You know, talking about it not just as a moral issue, but why are people coming to the United States? What's the relationship of U.S. foreign policy to why immigration happens? When we have those kinds of discussions, I've found, Eric, people's eyes start lighting up. They don't tend to think about it like that. I mean, certainly too many white people, when it comes to immigration, think about the myths of 19th century and early 20th century European immigration to the United States. And so they don't think in terms of U.S. foreign policy. So I think that there's ways that we can actually do this, but it is hard. It's going against the tide. We are fighting right-wing populism that tries to ridicule us. I mean, I just saw apparently Fox News was attacking Obama for being a socialist or something. I mean, come on. But if they're going after him as an alleged socialist, they try to ridicule, downplay, and demonize the types of things that you and I are talking about all the time.
Well, you know, it's funny. I'm trying to remember this film. It was a strange film. We both probably saw it, about the IRA, and it was with Stephen Rea and Forrest Whitaker in his early.
Oh, the quiet game of the.
Yeah, the crying game.
Crying game,
so,
right?
So he ends with this great story where he says, "Well, there's a tarantula and a turtle, and the tarantula says they're trying to cross the river, and the tarantula says to the turtle, would you give me a ride? And the turtle says, are you crazy? You're an uncontrollable killer. And the tarantula says, well, no, that's stupid. Do you know tarantulas can't swim? So there's no way I'm going to do this to you. So the turtle says, well, that's a good point. So the tarantula gets on his back, and as they get halfway across the river, the tarantula attacks the turtle and starts to kill him. And the turtle looks up and says, what in the world are you doing? He says, I can't help it. It's in my nature.
That's right.
And that's what imperialism, I've told that story so many times about, as a good way of understanding it, like you were saying, imperialism, and we're both looking at films, we're both trying to talk to people in popular ways, but I think it's interesting, Bill, that I think everybody is feeling more militant right now. I mean, the people that I'm working with, the young organizers, want to talk about empire, want to talk about the world. You know, I mean, I feel like there's something good, that kind of edge of outrage as you're talking right now, and this edge of kind of shaking people. I think that's a good, we're having very good results, especially with these young Black and Latino high school kids who would, thank God, you know, really, really doing some very impressive stuff.
I think that that's right.
And by the way, you should come out to the Strategy Center and talk to them more, because I want you to come out and talk to people about just your own historical perspective.
No, I would love to. Absolutely. We have to make that happen. I feel the same as you do, Eric, and I feel that when I go around the country. But it relates, going full circle to the beginning of this discussion, what remains missing is organization.
That's right.
And there continues to be this strange relationship that many younger activists have to organization. Either meaning, on the one hand, the only way I can be active is if I'm paid.
Right.
Right?
Yep.
Or, who needs organization? You know, I'll write a poem. I'll be militant. I'll have a demonstration, but I don't need organization. And so I feel that part of my mission in life has, in fact, been this issue of fighting for organization, not just creating them, but fighting for the centrality of organization, both as an intergenerational thing, but also as a way that you know and I know is the only way we'll win. And unfortunately, a lot of that has been lost.
Well, I think that's a big role that you and I have to play, Bill, because, you know, I don't know if you heard the interview with Sun Young Yang, but I know you just came back from Memorial. But yeah. She's a brilliant young organizer. Well, not, we knew her when she was real young. She's now probably in her early 30s, and she's going back to Korea for a couple of years. And the conversation about the absence of history, when I came out of Cornell in 1964. I went to work for CORE, luckily. I mean, a great gift. So right away, I was lucky enough to join. I mean, I was smart enough to join an organization and to actually get a job as a field secretary. And I was the only white Jewish, of course, field organizer in the North. But all the people that were talking to me, the Black people, started saying, I mean, every conversation would at least start in slavery. That's the earliest the conversation would start. And it would quickly go to Africa. And that was 64. By 65, 66, we were all in Vietnam. We were all in Africa. You know what I mean? We were all in Cuba. The conversation was historical and international.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that your role, if I could say one of your roles, is to play more of a role as a historian of your own work and summing more up about, like, you know, my history goes from CORE to the Newark Community Union Project to SDS to the weather above ground to meeting my wife, Leanne, to joining the League of Revolution, the August 29th movement, and going to be an auto worker, and then being the Revolutionary League of Revolutionary Struggle. And when I started the Strategy Center, it was a Black auto worker with whom I worked, Chris Mathis, a very brilliant guy. Mm-hmm. And after about 6 months, he said, you know, I've always known you're the smartest person, but you didn't make all that up. I mean, did you? I said, what do you mean? He says, I'm thinking you must have read some books.
Mm-hmm.
I said, oh, my God, I never gave you the Communist Manifesto. Of right. course. And I realized I was not doing my job, right, which is to teach people about history and to teach people about organization.
That's right. That's right. And so, you know, I agree with you. And I feel that this issue of speaking with people about history, in part, and this is not a joke, history in mainstream schools is among the most boring subjects for most people. And part of the reason is that it's taught ahistorically. It's taught it's just a series of facts, as opposed to helping people to understand currents and tendencies and getting people to ask the question, why did this happen, and things like that. That's one of the things that the left, and specifically Marxism, I think introduces, that it helps people really look at what has happened and make some sense out of it. And to me, that's incredibly exciting. So part of the job is to speak about history and to link it with what's going on today and why it is important for people to study. I was in Bogota, Colombia last week, just briefly, and I was in this meeting, and this person mentioned in passing that they haven't been teaching history in the schools.
Right.
And I said, wow, I mean, what happens when you don't teach history? Well, what happens is that people have no sense of themselves, no ideas to how they got to where they are, and in some ways, more importantly, they have no idea what to do. And I think that is one of the central roles that organizations like yours and others must play, that we've got to make history a regular part of the work that we do.
Well, tell our listeners, Bill, we have about 8 minutes. I want to do about 4 minutes on your own history and 4 minutes on Africa.
Sure.
So go slow a little bit, but, you know, you have started Harvard. I know you started actually with the Panthers, and I know a lot about your history. But walk our listeners through what your history looks like, just organization by organization.
Well, I started forming organizations when I was in high school.
Right.
And I was influenced by Malcolm X and by the Black Panther Party, the Young Lords Party. And when I got to college, I was actually planning on going on and becoming a lawyer. But I at that point realized that wasn't the direction I needed to go. And I had considered myself a socialist since before I actually knew what a socialist was.
Right.
But it seemed right, and all the right people were socialists. So, I studied it and became a Marxist and remain a Marxist. And when I was in school, one of the things that was critical was coming to get this sense of the importance of the working class and also the labor movement, the trade union movement. And I was fortunate that one of my mentors was Ewart Gannier, the father of Lonnie Gannier, who was the chairman of Afro-American Studies, and himself a longtime leftist, trade unionist at one point. And I left, I graduated from Harvard and went to work as a welder in a shipyard. Along with many other people of our generation who entered into the left, we decided that we would get involved in the working class, either at the workplace or in communities, to directly organize. And very few of us did that in paid positions. As paid organizers. You know, I was paid by the company I worked for, you know, and that was it, you know, and I had to raise hell. And if I had more time, I'd go into some more depth in this. But you did mention in the introduction about the Black Radical Congress.
Yeah, go there. That's important.
And that was a very important initiative for me. I worked with great people like late Manning Marable,
yeah.
Leith Mullings, Barbara Ransby, Abdul Al-Kalimat, in trying to bring together a united front of the black left. And, you know, Eric, if we had more time, I'd really like to explore that. I mean, Jamala Rogers, who you know out of St. Louis,
absolutely,
Organization of Black Struggle, and I co-authored this piece on lessons from the Black Radical Congress. And there was an attempt it was formed in 1998, to bring together different tendencies within the black left to work in a similar direction, recognizing that there were loads of differences, but nevertheless to work in similar direction. And it lasted until about 2009, but there are challenges that we ran up against, some of which we just simply could not overcome at that moment. There were generational challenges that existed, and one that haunts a lot of organizations is the refusal of baby boomers to embrace younger activists and to treat them as partners as opposed to treating them like kids. Another part of the generational divide is this thing that I've called the walkaway phenomena that I'm sure you've encountered among younger activists who, in the face of certain challenges and differences, will just simply walk away and won't engage in a struggle within an organization, which, you know, given my political background and training, has always been very hard to accept because I just sort of grew up with the idea that if you're an organization and there's a problem, you fight, you struggle it out. And only if you, at a certain point, feel like you can't make any headway, that's when you leave. But what we encountered in the BRC was something very different. And it was very unsettling. It remains unsettling, and I've seen that in other social movements.
Well, you know, Bill, I'd like to, when did you and Jamal, I should know, but when did you write the article? I'd love to read it, and I'd love to have you back on the show, and maybe we'll have Jamal, too, and talk about it.
That would be great. That would be great. It was within the last 6 months, Black Commentator.
Okay, great. Well, I'm going to go read it tonight. That's what I've been doing lately, just reading like a fiend. Well, one thing, just because we worked together on the Black Radical Congress, and obviously, you know, we sent Kikanza Ramsey and Chris Mathis and Barbara Lott Holland. And by the way, I just walked into the office today. I have to say, from our terrific young bookkeeper to our, I mean, the organization is becoming a really strong Black organization. It's always been strong, but just looking in the membership and this real strong Black Latino core of an organization is very inspiring, you know. And I think one of the things that I want to tell our listeners about is, of course, we're still having dinner, Bill, but they're listening in. So when I joined CORE, you know, here I am saying we shall overcome, and this is great. I joined the civil rights movement. Literally, the first day I was there, I was descended upon by three different factions of CORE, all of whom were trying to organize me into their faction. Now, I am totally, like you, are one step away from being that lawyer when I realized not to. So this is shocking to me. But for reasons I don't know, I did not walk away and say, well, this is, I'm sorry, this is too, you know, this is what, oh, I get it. This is going to be tougher than I thought. These are all good people. They all got a good point. But no, I don't agree with Bayard Rustin, who tried to overthrow the whole leadership of CORE and bring it into the Democratic Party. I didn't agree with James Farmer as much, but I thought he was very, very decent and good guy. And it's very interesting. I instinctively sided with the Black militants, you know, the Brooklyn CORE and the Bronx CORE and the, you know, and I went to school. They took me to school. They took me to Harlem and they, you know, hit me upside the head a few times and taught me some stuff. But I realized that I want to do this.
Right.
And, you know, that's it. It's not depressing. I get it. I've read history. Why do I think the left is going to be any different than all the shows you see about poisoning the king? You know, I mean, you don't have to like it, but I think you've done. So my point is that I think you did, this is important, a great job of trying to hold together a united front that at the time did not want to be together. That's my opinion. And you can't, you know, as great an organizer you are, Bill, you know, you can bring the family to dinner, but man, you know, some of those dinners are pretty rough. Right. And I think you should really, I mean this, feel really good about a lot of the work you've done as a bridge builder, as a person with tremendous sense of decency and willing to figure out anything to hold the, you know, you hold the team together. And I still think you're very needed, obviously. You've got a lot of great work ahead of you. But I think if you and I are saying we need to teach history, then you and I got to teach more history.
Yes. No, I think that that's absolutely right. And I'm flattered by what you said. Thank you very, very much. It's, I definitely...
Bill, I'm going to have to... I'm going to... Bill, I'm going to meet you for, we'll meet again for dinner very soon.
Very good.
Great to have you on the show, Bill.
Thanks,
that was Bill Fletcher. And hey, everybody, this is Eric, man. I'll tell you, I'm getting to like the show more and more as we've experimented with just free-form radio and getting great people on where I don't know what they're going to say, and I tell them, I ain't going to tell you what I'm going to say. And we just have a conversation, and G's telling me to get out of here. So this is Eric Mann on KPFK 98.7 FM. This is G, our engineer. Thanks to everybody, to Crystal McMillan for helping us produce the show. I'll see you next week from Voices from the Frontlines. Take good care of yourself.